Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Coming soon, a film by John Dahl, director of Red Rock West. Linda Fiorentino is Bridget, and Bridget is bad, bad to the bone.
You have your own place?
Yes.
Is it a sty?
No, it's clean.
Do you have indoor plumbing?
Bill Pullman is her loving husband, Clay.
Bridget!
And he wishes he never met her.
She stole a fortune from me after making me steal it, but she's not willing to give it up.
It's mine, you hit me.
Hey!
Can he afford a good lawyer?
Not anymore.
Peter Berg as Mike is about to join her.
How about us going out on an actual date sometime, you know?
Why?
On a roller coaster ride of desire.
I love you. I'm sure you feel the same way. I'm sure you love you too.
You have a way of making a woman feel like a one-way train ticket.
Greed.
I borrowed 100K from a man whose first and last names end in vowels. I hired a private detective for 50%. But I am perfectly willing to spend all of the money in hiring a clinical sociopath to take it from you.
Just for fun!
And revenge.
Wendy, maybe it's my quaint small-town morals, but I don't do murder.
Yeah, well, you would if you loved me. Is it the morality of murder that bothers you or the personal risk?
Murder is commitment?
Yeah, when I've done it and you haven't, it is.
Let's go for a little drive.
You're crazy.
You, me, $3 million?
And all I have to do is kill someone while you go apartment hunting?
Lady, you had your fun.
New York City, Mike?
I'm here to rob the place.
I thought you were the new decorator.
Where does this end with you?
Ow! What the hell are you doing?
Anybody checked you for a heartbeat lately?
Linda Fiorentino, Peter Berg, Bill Pullman.
You better run!
The Last Seduction. In a town called Beston, there is a woman who can't control her natural instincts.
I baked you some cookies.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Rob St. Mary is currently hauling a load of Coors in a cross-country race. I'm joined instead by special guest co-host, Miss Krista Faust.
Hey there, Fausketeers.
This week we're talking about The Last Seduction. Released in 1994, The Last Seduction is the third in a series of neo-noir films from director John Dahl, following Kill Me Again and Red Rock West. The Last Seduction stars Linda Fiorentino as Bridget Gregory, an icy cold dame who steals a load of loot from her husband, Clay, played by Bill Pullman, and makes her way to the sticks to cool her heels. There she meets Mike Swale, played by Peter Berg, a sad puppy dog of a man who thinks he can warm Bridget's heart. So, Krista, what's your history with The Last Seduction?
Well, I mean, that's kind of a funny question. I mean, my history is that I fucking love it. I mean, am I allowed to swear? I love it. It's a great film. I mean, you know, the thing I love the most about it is that the femme fatale wins.
Spoilers.
For me, you know, I mean, I see Bridget Gregory as a heroine.
Yeah, she's awesome. And it is nice to kind of root for the bad guy, as it were. And I really want to see her get away with everything that she tries to do.
Absolutely. And also, I think that she really brings to the fore what I see as the key to the femme fatale character, which is the artificially expressed vulnerability. The way that she does it is so brilliant. In that scene where she gives Mike the whole speech about, you know, I feel like I could really fall in love with you.
Why don't you just stay over?
I gotta get back.
Well, then I could come over. That's fine.
My place, my space, Mike. Don't get sticky.
What are you so scared of, huh? What are you so scared of?
I don't know. I guess it's because I've been hurt before. I don't want to get close to anyone right now. I'm different than the others, Mike. I feel like, well, maybe I could love you. I don't want that to happen, really. Will that do?
That idea that, like, I give you this idea that I'm vulnerable, but in reality, you know, I got my foot on the gas the whole time. And I love that.
Oh, yeah. And she is just playing everybody around her, no matter who it is. I especially love the part where Mike calls her and leaves the drunken message on her answering machine and talks about, if only I knew that you loved me, and then how she writes that cheesy little heart with Mike's name in it. And it's like, oh, man.
Oh, no, it's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, also being a New Yorker, you know, I love that the one New Yorker in a town full of hicks, you know, I can kind of relate to that.
She would be happy going to Chicago, but ending up in, what is it, Beston? Definitely not very happy being there.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, it's just, the movie is infinitely quotable. Fiorentino is brilliant. You know, everything about it is just flawless.
I think it's pretty much her strongest performance, at least for me that I've seen. I've never seen her top this role.
Total fucking bitch.
And I love Peter Berg. I've always enjoyed him. And seeing him as this kind of damaged guy with this big secret in his past that she slowly works on getting out. And then Bill Pullman really kind of matches her blow for blow. I mean, he's not nearly as masterful as she is, but just the way that he can clue into her, they are like really the perfect couple.
Absolutely. And it's just such a classic archetype, but it doesn't feel rehashed. It has a kind of a freshness at the same time as pushing all the buttons that we noir hounds love to have pushed.
Director John Dahl does a really good job of giving us enough throwback, you know, giving us the Venetian blinds, creating the patterns in the back without just being kind of ham-fisted when it comes to employing these kind of noir tropes.
I sort of cribbed this from Eddie Muller to a certain degree, but, you know, for me, noir has always been the writing more than the furniture. That is to say, I really respond to story tropes more so than the slanty light through the blinds, you know, and films that follow that visual cue, but that still have a happy ending or that, you know, in some way dilute, you know, that dark downward spiral. You know, I don't respond to them as much as I do stories that may seem more gritty or less visually luscious, you know, but still hit that fictional sweet spot.
Yeah, the writing is really tight. Just the way that the story comes together, the way that things build. I mean, really, there's not a wasted line in the film. It's pretty remarkable that this was Dahl's, I believe it was his third feature film. And before this, he had done Red Rock West and Kill Me Again, which are also, I highly recommend. They are terrific neo-noirs. Kill Me Again is Val Kilmer and Jonah Whaley Kilmer. She's really like a rough early draft of Bridget. There are even times where she kind of puts on that whole air of vulnerability that we see Bridget kind of doing later on. Especially, there's even, she kind of hides out and talks about how her husband is abusive. And in this case, he is really abusive. It's Michael Madsen as this ex-con who is basically a force of nature, and he is terrific in it. And then Red Rock West is another great one. And again, talk about a terrific story. I mean, I really can't recommend it enough. And this is one of those, I know you had mentioned that you kind of shy away from Nick Cage movies at times.
I wouldn't say it's a phobia, but it's always a crapshoot with him. You know, you don't know which version of him you're going to get.
Cage had done some craziness, of course, you know, Deadfall and Vampire's Kiss and those kind of things. But he really kind of was doing it right in this film. And it's kind of neat too. His character's name is Michael, so he's kind of the early version of the Peter Berg Mike character. And just the way he kind of comes into town and is looking for work and gets mistaken for a hired killer who is actually Dennis Hopper later on in the film. And Hopper is just spot on. He is amazing. He's not as crazy as Frank Booth, but he definitely has his moments. You know, one of the moments that always gets me in Last Seduction is, and it could be perceived as kind of a false note, but I think the more that I watch it, the more I enjoy this, is the way that Bill Pullman figures out where Bridget is and what name she's going under.
I can see why that might be seen as a little bit contrived, but it didn't bother me either.
I think he's so in tune with her. that he just gets it. And we've seen her mirror trick earlier on in the film. So he's kind of got, we've got that basis at least.
But at the same time, I mean, you know, I can see, you know, that somebody would point to that and say, come on, that's a little bit much. And, you know, if you see backwards writing on a mirror in the second act, somebody's going to get killed with it. I'm willing to overlook the little flaws because the overall writing is just so sharp.
I want to point out, especially Bill Nunn. I mean, he's not on screen for very much, but his role is terrific.
Oh, yeah. He's wonderful. He is absolutely wonderful. And I love her whole tearful speech about, you know, he was going to, you know, impale me. It's just so genius and so dead on.
I love that scene earlier where she goes into work and everyone's like, a black man was here.
Did you tell her about the black man?
Is that Noir Dog I hear in the background there?
Yeah, he's clicking around and jingling his little collar. What do you say there, Butch? There you go.
In a normal film noir, we would be saying, oh, yeah, well, this woman, we really shouldn't trust her. She's very duplicitous. She uses a backwards name. She writes backwards. You know, we're seeing this whole mirror image of her. But I love that we know from the get-go that she is as duplicitous as she's going to get. She continues to amaze us, but yet we know from the start that she is this kind of dark character.
Well, yeah, and I think that in a lot of ways, you know, it's almost wish fulfillment, you know, for women watching this film in the same way that a character like Mike Hammer, you know, is wish fulfillment for men, because you can't be a bitch like that. I mean, you can't. I mean, you can't function in society, you know, if you act that way. But boy, would you love to. She's in a way kind of aspirational in that she lets you live out your fantasy of just not giving a fuck what anybody thinks. And just getting what you need for yourself.
So do you wish you had a designated fuck?
Oh, I have designated fucks, honey.
Oh, nice.
I believe what we're looking for here is a certain horse-like quality. And if you don't like it, I'll designate someone else. But that's actually not, in my mind, her bitchiest moments. You know, I mean, I think that that manipulation, that selfishness, that cold-hearted, I mean, the whole setup at the end, you know, with the murder, I mean, that is just genius. And you know, no, you don't really want to kill anybody, but enjoying someone else doing it is, I think, you know, really part of the appeal for a lot of women.
It's interesting, too. What sets her off is Bill Pullman slapping her. Up to that point, she was absolutely fine with everything that was going to happen, that happened prior or that would happen afterwards. But that slap is what does it in for.
Is it? Or is that just her excuse? I wonder. I think maybe that's just, you know, I was going to do this anyway, but that's what I'm going to hang it on so that you know, have some sort of an explanation.
I like that even better. They kind of pick up on that in the very ill-begotten sequel, The Last Seduction 2, where we've got the return of Bridget going over to Barcelona and being chased by a private eye who is female private eye, which I thought was an interesting kind of twist on it, who is hired by Mike's father, since Mike is in the can and Mike's dad is pissed off and knows that Mike was set up, and there's this whole international intrigue, and Bridget falls in with this guy who owns a bar and who just happens to own a phone sex operation as well. And for her, it seems like, again, it seems, you know, to your point, it seems like she's going to screw this guy over, find out a way to siphon money off of these calls that he's getting because he keeps talking about how much money he's making. But it's when he punches one of the operators that seems to be the nail in the coffin for him.
No, I don't like that as well, because that I like her being completely amoral. She's not, you know, a battered woman. She's not protecting other people. She just wants what she wants, and it's that simple. You know, and that, to me, is the appeal of her character, that complete and utter lack of morality.
I saw this thing in the theater when it came out. You know, there's a long, sordid history of Dahl's early works, and we'll talk to him about that in a little bit here. And when that came out to the theater, I saw it way back in 94. I think I saw it on cable a few other times. But then when I was rewatching it again for this episode, I had forgotten how it ended. And I couldn't remember if she got her quote-unquote comeuppance or not. And when she doesn't, I love it.
The key to being a femme fatale is not just to find a guy who's dumb. It's to find a guy who wants to believe what you're telling him. That's the key. Because, you know, if you're just an idiot, then, you know, it doesn't work. You need a guy who's smart, but is deliberately going against his instinct because you've got him by the short and curlies.
All right, well, let's take a break, and we'll be back with an interview with director John Dahl.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
I'm Dangerous Jamie. Joining me as always is Sarah. And we're going to talk to you about why you should be listening to the Gore Press Broadcast.
Let's do that.
Let's indeed. Why should they be listening to the Gore Press Broadcast?
Well, firstly, because it's awesome, obviously.
Obviously. I mean, that's a given or a given.
A given, yeah. You can expect nonsensical puns like that.
Yeah, with zero context.
Absolutely zero context.
But also, we review horror films.
Mostly, we review horror films, I would say.
Well, yeah, that's probably the bulk of what we do.
Yep.
We also look at new releases, top five lists.
Yeah.
We cover theme months.
Yeah, we do some horror news.
Yeah, tell us about the theme months that we covered.
We have done Horror Behind Bars.
Yeah, we did Clown Town, where we looked at clown movies.
We did. We've done Trash Kings.
Trash Kings, where we looked at the films of Fred Olen Ray, Jim Wynorski and David Zuccotto.
Yeah, we've done a bunch of stuff. We've got Revenge Month in the works, Trauma Month. So yeah, loads of stuff like that.
Loads of stuff. So if you like horror films, you should probably listen to the Gore Press Podcast.
Absolutely.
We're here and we're ready to believe you. So that's not all you can get. You can also get extra super bonus content when you subscribe to the feed. Tell about it, Sarah. Tell them now.
We do the Gore Press Gormentry, which is basically us shamelessly ripping off Mystery Science Theatre. Yeah, basically getting drunk, chatting over the top of a film, and hopefully being quite entertaining, I think.
There are two ways to find the show. You can find us over at iTunes by searching for the new Gore Press Gorecast.
You can indeed.
Or you can go to gorepress.com and read all the great reviews, news, interviews and everything, all there alongside the podcast.
Yeah.
So come on, subscribe to the new Gore Press Gorecast. Tune in, drop out, stay spooky.
Wow.
I'd recommend this show to anybody. Anybody who's into smut.
Good evening, folks. Do you enjoy action and adventure? Romance and comedy? How about long strolls on the beach and a fine champagne by moonlight? Do you like pina coladas and getting caught in the rain? Or would you rather listen to some in-depth conversation about film where many timely and poignant observations and witticisms are made? Mo here from the Drunk on VHS podcast. And if you like any of those things, then I have some bad news for you. Drunk on VHS has none of these. But you should listen anyway. Because I asked him nicely and said, please. Oh, wait. Please. Tune in every Wednesday for new episodes exclusively at CouchKitten.com.
Bring the family. Bring your friends.
I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about how you got into the business.
In high school, I was interested in art and music. I played in rock and roll bands. I got out of high school. I went to art school for a couple of years. I thought, how am I going to make a living being an artist? So I took a year off and worked as a commercial artist and played in a band, and then realized that there was a film school. I could go to film school. I was always interested in film and a little bit more so in animation because I like to draw. And I went to film school. And once I went to film school, I just kind of got hooked. Thought I wanted to be a cameraman. And I realized that I'd always kind of told stories through cartoons. And there was a lot of people in my school that wanted to be do camera, and not that many directors. So I kind of got started by drawing cartoons and turning them into little movies. You know, kind of got the bug there. And so went to film school, eventually moved to Los Angeles, went to the American Film Institute, started writing scripts and drawing storyboards, and eventually wrote and or co-wrote and directed Kill Me Again. You know, and then along the way, I directed, you know, the first little experience I had directing commercial projects was music videos. I did a lot of storyboards on music videos and movies. I did the storyboards for Something Wild and Married to the Mob for Jonathan Demme, and I did RoboCop for Paul Verhoeven. Then I got to start, you know, I had written a script. First script that I wrote was called PI, Private Investigations, and then by then I'd written my own script and started directing.
What was PI, Private Investigations, like?
That was interesting because it was basically Nigel Dick, who was a music video director. Hologram Records wanted to make a movie and put some, you know, kind of put together a music, you know, a lot of songs from, you know, so that Nigel wrote a treatment for a private investigator in Los Angeles. And then Dave Warfield and I wrote the script for it, and Polygram made the movie. It was the same people that were involved in Propaganda Films. That's the same group of people that I made Kill Me Again with, which was Yanni Sigbots and Steve Dolan, Polygram Films. Dave Warfield wrote and produced it. I directed it. So it was kind of the same group of people.
With that, and with Kill Me Again, and Red Rock West, Last Seduction, Fallen Angels, I mean, these were some of the, you know, especially with Red Rock West and Last Seduction, you know, I consider them some of the strongest neo-noirs that were coming out at the time. Were you a big film noir fan or a hard-boiled detective fan?
It was interesting because when I was in art school, I remember walking by this used book sale, and there was these Pulp Fiction covers of books, and they just kind of cracked me up because I love the names. One was I Wake Up Screaming. And then coincidentally, one of my favorite artists, Edward Hopper, also did these kind of haunting paintings, but he also designed magazine covers. So there was kind of like a graphic element that I always liked graphic art. I worked for a billboard artist. I always loved the graphic, quick, immediate imagery that, you know, commercial art created. So I think I fell in love with the artwork of Pulp Fiction covers first. And then when I was first places that I remember taking a trip from Montana down to see a friend of mine in San Francisco on a bus. And I, you know, one of the stops that we had was in Reno, Nevada. And as a kid growing up in Montana, I'd never seen anything like Reno, Nevada, like gambling 24 hours a day. If you've ever been to Reno, it's kind of this interesting collision of kind of pop culture and the West and the 50s. Not quite as Art Deco as L.A., but it's got this kind of great design concept to it. You know, I was really struck with the imagery of the town. Then when I was driving from Montana down to Los Angeles to go to the American Film Institute, I remember like kind of going through Las Vegas and in an event that sort of blew my mind, these, you know, weird kind of gambling places. Now I'm living in Los Angeles, and I'm one of the first, and I'm not quite sure why, but we screened at the American Film Institute, we screened Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity. And those movies just blew me away because, you know, it's like really the first time I'd seen them and to see them on screen. Now, my father was in the insurance business. I had no idea that Double Indemnity and selling insurance could be nearly as sexy and dangerous as that. Also, I'm living in Los Angeles, and these locations for Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity are right in Hollywood, like the Aldo Nido Hotel is at the top of Yucca, you know, not far from the Capitol Records Tower. And I was living in Los Feliz, by the American Film Institute, Vermont Avenue. And these are all locations for Double Indemnity and Sunset Boulevard. So, like, living in this area, you know, and then, like, driving past Paramount Studios, and it's like, you know, all of this is starting to become very real in this kind of surreal Pulp Fiction kind of way. And then, you know, oddly enough, my partner Dave and I had written a horror film. We were trying to get any kind of movie we could make. We thought we could maybe make a horror film. The title that we had selected was called Silent Night. Of course, here we are going to destroy like the most beloved Christmas Carol ever. Then somebody came out with a movie titled that. And so we had to come up with a new name. You know, and we had some interest in this group. So we're sitting around throwing out titles for kind of coming up with as many versions of kill, death, destroy, you know, destruction, kill me again. And then, wait a minute, that's kind of funny. Kill me again. How could you possibly get a character to say, I want you to kill me again in a movie? That was the hook for us. And then I remember these like Pulp Fiction covers and these kind of crazy titles like, you know, DOA, Dead on Arrival, I Wake Up Screaming. It's a hook. So all these elements kind of, you know, get pulled together. and we start coming up with the script. You know, by now we've gone to American Film Institute. We've written a couple of scripts. The script kind of actually came together pretty quickly once we kind of pulled that hook together. You know, the script was strong enough that we shopped it around a little bit, and Propaganda agreed to let us make it and let me direct it. That's how we got that movie made. Basically, Red Rock was kind of bits and pieces of that. You know, sort of like, you know, I've kind of done this my whole life. I'll start one thing, and then I'll realize all the I could have made that a little better. I could have done this or whatever. So part of Red Rock West really was sort of like, I think I was on a location scout in Reno, and I walked into this bar, and I thought, man, this is the kind of place you'd walk in and arrange for somebody to whack your wife or something like that. It just seems so dangerous and lawless, I guess. And then so bits and pieces of Red Rock West started to kind of come together as a result of making Kill Me Again. And that was really more like I wanted to kind of make a spaghetti Western, you know, set in Montana, basically, but with a, you know, with a, I guess, I never really thought of it as quite as being a noir Western, but I guess that kind of, that's sort of what it ended up being. And then Last Seduction, when I read that script, I really thought of it more as a black comedy. I mean, I remember Linda Fiorentino, she went over to France and they screened it at the Ville Film Festival. And she called me on the phone. She said, you can't believe how much people like this movie. And they were calling me like a femme fatale in the movie. So really? So it never occurred to me. You know, it never occurred to either Linda and I that she was like a femme fatale. We just thought she was a horrible monster of a character. You know, we were thinking more of like this insanely weird, funny woman, you know, in a really sort of vicious way. But Last Seduction kind of, you know, came together sort of uniquely out of these other experiences. But it was, you know, none of it was by design, let's put it that way.
But it's so funny because I figured you had to be like a big Jim Thompson fan to do Red Rock West, and, you know, big fan of Detour to do Last Seduction. So it's great to hear that these are, you know, coming from other places, but can kind of be recast as neo-noir.
As a film student, you can't help but watch noir movies and fall in love with them because they're so beautiful. And of course, you know, and I've seen hundreds of noir movies, and I love them. You know, and I think moving to Hollywood and then starting to read a little bit of Dashiell Hammett, and of course, I loved Charles Bukowski, because it was like he lived in the neighborhood I was living in, you know, and I think Dashiell Hammett lived up the street from the apartment that I was living, you know, so it was like all around you. Was I like a diehard noir geek fan? No, not really. My first real appeal to all of that whole world was really almost on a visual level. And as I began to kind of like look at the visual level and understand the visual parts of it, I realized, you know, I had seen so many noir films sort of done badly. I know, you know, actually another two movies that were really big impact on me were Chinatown and Body Heat. Great movies. And those had a huge impact on me. But I realized that, you know, you couldn't just put a set of Venetian blinds on somebody because it had been done so badly in music videos in the 80s. But you couldn't rely just simply on style. The style had to come out of the material organically. It was really more about the story that you were telling rather than just the style. And I think where a lot of noir movies, for me anyway, fall down is there's just too heavily of a reliance on style and not enough on, you know, the sort of the dark parts of those stories. It's like these ambiguous, you know, morally flawed characters. And I guess as a young artist, I could sort of identify with, you know, all those characters. You know, how do I get ahead? How do I make some money? I'm just like a guy trying, I'm on the make, and I'm trying to like make something of myself. And, you know, am I the smartest guy in the world? No. Am I capable of making a bad choice? Yes. You know, it's like those moral flaws that, you know, that everybody can relate to. And at some point in a noir movie, you're watching and you kind of go, wow, I don't know if I'd do that, but yeah, I did that. And you watch Body Heat and you're right there with William Hurt all the way through the movie. You'd do the same thing. You know, you're a young guy and you have and Kathleen Turner standing there, you know, with a cigarette in her mouth, you know, you make those bad decisions, you know, and then when it falls down on you, you know, you know why and you know where, and, you know, it's like that sinking feeling like, you know, yeah, somebody was calling your hotel room all night last night. Where were you? And you just go, oh man, I've been fucked over. I think there's something about it is like, to me in a way, it's like as a young art student that I could totally identify with those characters. And I think there's a naivety and an innocence that I had at that time that was, you know, that was kind of part of who I was at that time. So now I'm a much more cynical and jaded guy, and it's harder to be that naive anymore. But, you know, for that time when I was, a young filmmaker in Hollywood, you know, those stories really resonated to me.
You had done music video directing and everything. How was it moving from that world into directing a feature with Kill Me Again? Or were there any kind of interim steps there, or did you just kind of jump in?
It was a great experience doing these music videos. I mean, I so wanted to do feature films, so every time I'd get an opportunity to do a music video, I'd try to, you know, tell some big story with it or whatever. I'd always be trying to put some kind of story concept in it. You know, I was, you know, pretty focused on writing at that time. You know, so I was writing and directing music videos and doing my first film. You know, there were so many. I mean, I'd done about 30 music videos by the time I directed my first film. So I'd been on a film set, but I hadn't had to work with actors like that. I hadn't had to hold the crew together for like 2 months. I, you know, moved from town to town and sort of deal with all the mechanics and. I mean, it's really like a trial by fire. Almost everybody gets to direct one movie. Directing your second movie is much harder, and directing the third is nearly impossible. Directing the fourth is even crazier. You know, I mean, very few people get to direct very many movies. You know, you have to learn through each one of those experiences. And anybody that's ever gone through it, you know, you just realize that you're really not prepared to do any of it. So you are bounced around and tossed around, and you know, everybody else has more experience than you do. You know, by the end of it, you're just sort of flying by the seat of your pants and hoping that it works. You know, anybody that's ever directed a movie that's gone through that long sort of process, all the ideas that you're sort of wrestling with, and the personalities, and then the politics of it, and it's often you know, process. But I mean, it's great fun if you know, it's like you'll never hear anybody complain about it, because it's a great experience if you ever get to do it. I think after my first experience, I would have described it as like you're at one end of a football field, and you've got a 5-gallon bucket of water, and your goal is to get to the other end of the football field without, and if you have any water left at all, you've succeeded. And then there's about 25 people out there that are trying to, you know, tackle you as you're running from 100 yards. I think that was my analogy at the time. For me, I think I was fortunate that I had done so many storyboards, and I had some experience doing music videos. So I think I storyboarded the whole movie. You know, I had a great cameraman that worked with me, you know. Of course, you know, Dave Warfield, the producer, was a great ally. You know, I had a lot of, you know, great people working with me. It was not easy working with Val Kilmer. He was a handful. John Wally was great. Michael Madsen was fantastic. I had lots of great people helping me, but it was hard. It was hard. It was demanding.
You don't seem to have picked some of the easiest people in the world to work with. Looking at Kilmer, I don't know how Nicolas Cage was to work with, or Dennis Hopper. I know Linda Fiorentino seems to have kind of a reputation, so that you worked with her twice. It's like, wow.
Probably Val Kilmer was the most challenging person I worked with, because I was a first-time director. Val's a very talented guy, but he's also a real challenge for directors. So that was, you know, was not easy. Red Rock West was actually, you know, Nicolas Cage was fantastic. Dennis Hopper was fantastic. You know, J.T. Walsh. I mean, that J.T. Walsh is amazing. I mean, that was, you know, the cast was fantastic on that. There was other, you know, of course, there's always issues, but you know, I had a slow cameraman, but he did a great job, you know. Last Seduction was really a lot of fun. Linda Fiorentino was in a great frame of mind. She was fantastic. Peter Berg was amazing. Of course, Bill Pullman, you know, the cast was great. And by then I'd hooked up with this pretty amazing cameraman, Jeff Dürer, and I've done like half the movies I've done, Jeff has shot, you know, I really sort of hit it off with Jeff. The Last Seduction was probably the most pleasant film experience, because the guy who greenlit the movie basically left the company 1 week after we started shooting, and a new group of people came in. They inherited this movie. None of them really wanted it or knew what to do with it, but it was cheaper to let us just continue shooting it. So we are now, you know, had the great, John Shethick was a great, you know, was a great producer. We had the typical sort of, you know, budget issues, but the people that were making it pretty much left us alone. We finished the film. We screened it for the studio once. They had a couple of notes. They didn't really know what to do with it. We just finished the movie. We never even did a test screen with that film. And the first time I saw that film finished was with an audience at the, I think we showed it at the American Film Institute. Nobody really knew what to do with it, or, you know, wanted it, or, you know, they, you know, supposedly they tried to sell it in Hollywood. Supposedly everybody watched it. Nobody liked it, you know, and then it went over to, you know, a French distributor entered it at the Deauville Film Festival, and people over there loved it. And then a guy named Jeff Lipsky, who started October Films, you know, called me up and said, you know, could we release this movie in the United States? great. I think it had already showed on, was it HBO or Showtime? I can't remember. They bought two prints of it, right? And they did a showing in Los Angeles and New York. And the whole success of his, you know, launch of The Last Seduction was based on, virtually it was on a review from the New York Times. So the movie screened, I think on Friday, you know, I think it was even Thursday night. I think it was Thursday. And then we went over to Sardi's, you know, that restaurant across the street from where everybody sits around and waits for the reviews. I remember sitting in the bar and the paper came out and we read the review and, you know, I think I read it three times because I couldn't believe how good it was. And he was thrilled over the moon. And so they started bicycling prints of Last Seduction around the United States. It was successful for them, you know, and obviously successful for all of us. But, you know, even with Red Rock West, the same thing happened. It wasn't like, you know, people in Hollywood looked at these movies and had no interest in them. And then the movies left Hollywood and found an audience elsewhere and then eventually made its way back to Hollywood.
There was a little bit of a time gap between Kill Me Again and Red Rock West. Was that just trying to get that second feature made?
Yeah. Kill Me Again was made, but I mean, it's kind of like snake bit from, I think Val was not that crazy about the movie. He didn't really, you know, I think the guys at MGM didn't really know what to do with it. The one major city that we got to show it in was San Francisco. And of course, the weekend, this is how, you know, lucky or unlucky I've been. The weekend that they're going to show it in San Francisco is, let's see, did they have the earthquake? I think they had this earthquake, the one that knocked down the 60 freeway, a really bad earthquake in San Francisco. And it was at the same time that the Giants were playing Oakland in the World Series, right? So Subway Series. The earthquake has happened. And now we're the weekend that the series starts back up. It's like a week and a half after the earthquake and, you know, we're being released and everybody's, you know, basically watching the World Series. I think five people saw the movie in San Francisco. Fortunately for me, one of the persons that, you know, I think saw the movie there became Francis Coppola. So when eventually he started trying to cast Red Rock, I think Coppola mentioned to Nicolas Cage, yeah, you know, take a look at that script. And somehow that helped us, like, you know, directly, indirectly. But no, it, really not a lot of people saw Kill Me Again, but we actually got some pretty decent reviews. And I think, you know, MGM was a little embarrassed by, you know, the fact that they had really kind of thrown the movie, you know, we're going to just sort of toss it away. And all of a sudden they got these, like, you know, pretty decent reviews for it. You know, they were a little embarrassed. It seems to me like the executives that, you know, or the people that were involved in, you know, pretty much in all three of those movies, underestimated these movies, never really watched them with an audience, and dismissed them as being, I don't know, sort of quirky or subtle or, you know, not electrifying, you know, not an obvious sale. Red Rock West, that was a good one too, because we were getting ready to screen the test screening, you know, how test screens work there. All the marketing guys come and they make all their decisions based on that. And then the LA riots happened. So they canceled the test screening. I don't know, maybe a month later, we're going to do our test screening. Now all the executives that were supposed to go to the, you know, to see Red Rock West with an audience have now all gone to the Cannes Movie Festival. So basically, it's my brother and I and the editor go out and watch this movie, you know, Red Rock West with an audience in the Valley and a marketing guy from Polygram. The numbers are good. They're, you know, they're pretty good, but they're not like, wow, this is the best movie I've ever seen. So on paper, you look at it, but the audience, you know, was pretty appreciative of it. The marketing guy was like, well, you know, it's not a comedy. You know, Nicolas Cage is known for his comedy, and it's not an action movie. It's kind of in between those two. So in my opinion, you need to either make it more funny or it's got to be more of an action movie. So well, what do you suggest? He said, I don't know, like something like, you know, instead of Dennis Hopper dying in the movie, in the cemetery, he's like driving the train at the end of the movie, and then he and Dennis Hopper, Nicolas Cage and Dennis Hopper are on the top of the train and they get into a big fist fight, kind of like they did in Speed, which came later. But how would I get Dennis Hopper from being dead to driving a train? What do you, how would we do that? He said, I don't know, you're the writer, you figure it out. But, you know, that was their sort of, you know, so they just kind of dismissed it. Nobody from Polygram watched it, you know, and so they moved on to the next thing. So the movie got made, it's finished. Propaganda, the movie that they had just finished, Ruby, the man who shot the man who shot JFK, which nobody saw. But that was their big movie, right? Danny Aiello, right? And that came out and it just tanked. And so next up from the same group of people as Red Rock West with Nicolas Cage, and they said, we're not going to distribute it, which was a big bummer. Really, you know, obviously, that's horrible. So anyway, it ended up going, that's why it sort of like just found its way to France again, and they loved it. And that actually, the Canadian distributor saw it in France, loved it, and then he entered it into the Toronto Film Festival. At that point, we weren't sure if we were still hoping to get distribution in the United States. So we got Dennis to go see it, you know, got him to go to Toronto with me, and we went to Toronto. And, you know, like this is the first time that one of the producers ever saw a movie with an audience. So we're watching the movie at the Toronto Film Festival. I'm sitting next to the producer, and the movie's over, and he says, "Hey, Dahl, they actually really liked the movie." Yeah, go figure. By then, the die was already cast. It was like going to be sold off and just sold on cable, and you know, because you get a certain guaranteed dollars if it's first run on cable. They sold it off, and then, oddly enough, a guy in San Francisco saw it at the Toronto Film Festival. He owns the Roxy Theater, and he had this little company called Roxy Releasing in San Francisco. And he called me and said, "Hey, can we release Red Rock West in the United States?" And he got a call, you know, Columbia, I think they owned it at the time. So he called them, and then Columbia said, "Well, okay." You know, I think they were just sort of more annoyed anyway. They said, "Yeah, we'll give you a print." They gave us one print, and we had a big world premiere at the Roxy Movie Theater in San Francisco. This is before Last Seduction. So my brother and I go to San Francisco, you know, on the opening night at the Roxy Theater. I think a reviewer sitting there in the audience with everybody watching it for the first time. And people loved it. You know, we got a great review. And all of a sudden, like Columbia, now all of a sudden they've got this great review, San Francisco, and then another great review from Toronto. And they're sort of embarrassed because they've already sold it to some cable. So we could rent it on video. And I think it ended up being one of the longest playing movies, in New York City that year, like the Lincoln Center, wherever. By then, I'm making Last Seduction, and pretty much the same thing happens with that. You know? So, yeah.
So were the companies you were working for mad at you?
I don't know. What can I say? I'm a kid from Montana. I got to come to Hollywood and make movies. It's, the politics of, making movies in Hollywood and dealing with, the egos and the, executives and, it's very challenging. I'm thrilled I kind of got to make those three movies really sort of under the radar. It was a great sort of experience for me. And then, I've been very fortunate that I've always been able to make movies that I really wanted to make, so can't complain.
Now, how was it working with your brother on Red Rock?
Right. He was an English student he was more interested in novels, and he graduated from Rutgers with a degree in English and was working in New York City and just kind of like a desk job, and writing at night. And I said, "Well, you should come to Hollywood." At that time, I was going to direct Kill Me Again. I said, get your job as a PA. So he worked on that, and then he was doing a couple other things. And then after, I had some bits and pieces of, basically had this idea of a guy walking into a bar, and it was a mistaken identity because, they saw the Texas license plate, and he had just assumed that he was a hitman that he ordered up from Texas. So we started picking it around, and then Rick came up with a great twist that the villain, the guy running the bar was actually also the sheriff as well. We just kind of, took it from there.
Yeah, I love the twists and turns that movie takes, just everything. The way that Nicolas Cage finally runs into Dennis Hopper and just all of those, it just fits together in such a nice package.
The very first draft of that was much darker. The last act was quite dark. I actually don't even really remember exactly what it was, but we sent that out and really got nobody was interested in it. So then we're like, what do we do now? And so we're sitting around trying to think of, where do we start with this? And where do we want to go? And then we kind of came across the idea, could we really rip off the best deal? Would anybody ever figure it out? And we thought, let's try it. And so we buried the money in a graveyard and ripped off, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Once we put an ending on it, we had all kinds of interest in it. But, it was like the first two thirds were really fun twists and turns, and then just kind of like, it just sort of drove off the cliff. And it was, you're asking it was really hard to, make the second one made, especially once we had the script that kind of okay, but not great.
It's funny. We were watching Red Rock again last weekend, my wife and I, and she hadn't seen it before. And when it came to the graveyard scene, she was like, "Oh, it's in the grave of Bill Carson."
Is it Bill Carson? Where's the guy? I don't remember.
Yeah, that's what it was from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah,
the
one, maybe it was. Maybe we.
The one next to.
Yeah. So she caught on to it, huh? It's amazing. No, most people didn't, but yeah.
Well, she has to watch all the movies I watch, so.
Right.
You know, I have to say, the performances you've gotten out of people have just been every single time. And I know you said that Val Kilmer wasn't crazy about Kill Me Again, but his performance in that is, to me, one of the best things that he's done. And then same thing for Nicolas Cage in Red Rock West. I mean, that's one that I can continue to go back to. And, you know, now he's kind of become a little bit of a joke sometimes with some of the movies that come out. And it's like, what happened to Nicolas Cage? And it's like, you know, you got to go back and see some of these older films that he did. He was amazing in these. So to see, you know, his performance and Dennis Hopper in this and J.T. Walsh was just fantastic.
Yeah, he's so strong as an actor. Yeah, I think I met him when we were casting Kill Me Again, and I can't remember what he came in for, but I was just so impressed with him. And I remember Nick was saying, well, you know, this guy JT, we see, is he going to be really menacing enough as the sheriff? It's like, you know, we did a rehearsal, and JT Walsh is so like unbelievably intense. And Nick kind of said, yeah, I think he's going to be plenty intense. You know, I mean, he was great. He what a talent he was. Sorry that he died so young. It's just sad.
I was glad to see him show up in The Last Seduction as well. You know, he kind of grounds the insanity that's going on around him.
It was great. All I had to do was get him, I had to guarantee him that he could have the cowboy boots. He said, can I have the clothes that I wear if I do the movie? I said, sure. So we got him a nice pair of cowboy boots. He was a funny guy because he was a theater actor, you know, and it was like just kind of living, sometimes not really living hand to mouth, but you know, he was, you know, a character actor, and he was just a real character. But yeah, he wanted his wardrobe, and so we said, you know, yeah, great, you can have it, you know, because I think we got him to do it for hardly anything, but yeah, he was terrific.
I had read that you had a little bit of a problem just getting Dennis Hopper to agree to be in the movie. Is that true?
What happened with Dennis Hopper is we had originally wanted to cast him to play the part of the sheriff. And I went over to his house in Venice and to meet him. And I get there thinking I'm going to talk to him about being the sheriff in the movie. You know, he's read the script. He said, oh, I think I'd be, you know, I'd just be a great Lyle from Dallas. And I'm, I wanted to talk to you about playing the part of the sheriff. Oh, no, I don't want to be the sheriff. I think I'd be a great killer. Well, yeah, but Dennis, don't you think you've done that? You know, Mr. Hopper, well, you've kind of done the killer thing a lot. He said, oh, no, but I'd be great in this with Nick. And I said, well, you know what, I'm going to have to think about that. I said, okay, well, you let me know. And I'm like, you know, it's, you know, and I'm walking out of his house, and it's all filled with Andy Warhols, and, you know, he's such a character. And I drive away and I call the producer and I say, you know, I kind of have a problem. Dennis wants to play the sheriff. Oh, geez. Oh, well, what do we do? I don't know. I think we have to find another, you know, we got to find somebody else. So now we're kind of like, you know, we're in pre-production and we're working on the movie. And like 3 weeks later, I'm in a Best Western in Arizona. And I get this phone call from Dennis Hopper, and he's at a film. He's at a festival in Sweden for some film that he's doing, and he just, you know, he calls me again, and he's like so enthusiastic. Yeah, I really want to play this part. You know, I hope you'll consider. And I don't know, Dennis, let me think about it. And now I hang up, and I'm thinking to myself, I don't even know how Dennis Hopper found me, because I'm in this like little middle of nowhere, literally. And I get this great guy, this great star, calling me, wanting to be in the movie. You know, maybe I should, you know, reconsider this. You know, I think one of the things, you know, I'd met J.T. Walsh before, and I think when I kind of started to kind of think about how I could make it work, I realized, oh, you know what, I could probably get J.T. Walsh to play the sheriff. It sort of felt, you know, but, you know, what am I being crazy? This is, you know, I got this guy, you know, this amazing actor hounding me to be in the movie. I should take advantage of that. So one person that I really, really enjoyed working with is Terry Dresbach, who I think she had just done a couple of movies, but she is the costume designer on Kill Me Again, and hard time finding a wardrobe. It's just so, you know, just took forever. And so we kind of, both of us were sort of like learning as we were going. And then on Red Rock, she had kind of come up with this concept, which I loved. What she did, she got all these clothes that we both liked, and she put them in a room, And then she basically let Dennis Hopper walk into the room and pick out the clothes that he wanted to wear. So he, you know, he goes, for then you, you know, you got this actor walking into this room and he's thinking, you know, and then there's their choice, not ours, right? So they become involved in creating that character. It's a very, you know, empowering thing for an actor to kind of create their own character. Dennis ends up pulling off the rack this wacky polyester weird ranch outfit, you know, that you know, it's got this kind of like black pants and this black, you know, it's just like, you know, it's a JR ranch wear sort of like, wow, that's pretty wacky, you know, and he looked great in it, you know, and he had this little bolo tie and, you know, and he just kind of became that character and it was great. And I mean, that's Terry did, she did that and Last Seduction and Unforgettable, and she did Rounders as well. Same thing, just fill the room full of clothes. It was kind of shocking what John Malkovich came up with, these kind of cheesy polyester shirts that had these patterns on them and kind of like this Euro trash, weird Russian gangster thing going on. It was really fun working with, you know, I have to give Terry some credit for helping develop those characters for those, you know, creating a comfortable way for those actors to kind of begin, you know, to enter into who that character ultimately becomes. Because, you know, it's like, it's one thing to kind of create a part on paper for somebody or imagine it, you know, and this is the one thing that I love about actors. It's like, you know, really at the end of the day, there's really only two people on a film set that are at any risk, you know, are the two most vulnerable people really are the actor and the director. You bring this guy or this woman and they go through this gauntlet every morning of like putting on hair, makeup, wardrobe, you know, standing in front of a mirror, memorizing these lines. Then you shove them out of their trailer, walk them over to a set. All right, now perform. I mean, it takes a special kind of person that wants to do that. And so creating a sort of a safe, you know, working environment for that person to kind of come in and feel like they can experiment and they can try things. And you know, it's, you know, because really, I mean, a lot of a performance depends on, you know, what you get out of the actor on the day and what the environment is on the set. I hear about these sets where everybody's always screaming and yelling at everybody. And I don't know how that can be like, an exciting working environment. But, you know, you want it to be a place where, you know, an actor can come in and, you know, experiment and sort of find the character, you know, and develop who that person is and pretend to be Lyle from Dallas. Or, you know, if the actor can convince themselves that they're that character in that moment, there's a much better chance that they'll work on the film. You know, you really have to get the actor has to kind of really embrace that part and that moment. You know, and that's how I think you get, you know, the most out of people.
Two scenes that I always go back to in my head when it comes to Red Rock West, for some reason, are both scenes of Cage and Hopper in a car. That whole thing when they meet, I love their first meeting. And then that whole thing where he's racing that train and just Dennis Hopper just laughing his head off. Right. I love that.
Yeah. And Nick's looking at him like, this guy's fucking insane. Yeah. So another one, I really like that scene with JT Walsh where he's in the car with Nick. He's driving him out of town. He's going to shoot him. He's got him, you know, let him escape from his truck.
Which kind of comes back when Linda Fiorentino's driving Bill Nunn.
Yes. Yeah, that was pretty funny. He's a phenomenally talented guy.
I have to ask about The Last Seduction, the introduction of Peter Berg and Linda Fiorentino in that in the bar there.
Uh-huh.
So much stuff going on in that scene. I just love how many different things are happening and that whole thing about being polite in the town and all that stuff.
Right.
The moment when she sniffs her hand, was that scripted?
I don't think that was. I think that was Linda, you know.
That was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, Steve Brancic, the guy who wrote the script, was, you know, I mean, really just funny situations, you know, and what's interesting with Steve is that I think he really thought it was more like a dramatic movie, like Body Heat, dark and serious. I mean, really? How's she going to be doing this in a sitting there at a bar? And, you know, I don't know. It was, you know, and once he saw, you know, once he started to see how the movie was coming together, he realized, oh yeah, you're right. This is pretty darn funny. But the way it was written and the way it was on the paper, it was, you know, it was pretty damn funny. I mean, there was very few things that we took out of the original script that Steve wrote. I mean, I read the script and was laughing the whole time. I, you know, but, you know, again, I could I can relate to the script because I can relate, you know, like I'm the young, naive, innocent rube from a small town, you know, from Montana. I can relate to the Peter Berg character. But the other thing was really hard casting that part because, you know, most guys wanted to be like sort of a tough guy. They didn't want to like, met a lot of actors for that part. Peter was one of like the last guys we met, you know, and I ended up talking to him for like an hour. And it's really interesting. He's probably one of the more interesting actors I'd ever met at that time because he understood the whole script and he understood what part he had to play in the story and that it wasn't really that. He so kind of so understood the script. Really not a surprise that he's, you know, now directing movies because he had such an analytical approach to it, you know, from the get-go. It's really interesting. We were doing one of the scenes. I think we were doing a scene where she's leaving. They just had sex and she's leaving and she says, well, maybe I'll come and fuck you again, but maybe I won't. And he's getting kind of riled up like any guy would. And I was watching the scene and just kind of wasn't working. And I'm just sitting there thinking, you know, oh, I got some, this isn't working. And then it occurred to me, and I just said, you know, Peter, I think you just have to be Jimmy Stewart in this movie. And he looked at me and he went, oh, yeah, you're right. And then it kind of became, gosh, golly, well, maybe you'll come back tomorrow. And there's that scene where he runs out as she's driving away and he's in his underwear, looking at him like a puppy dog, you know. And that's, you know, that was like hard for a lot of actors to know. But as soon as I said that, Peter understood it and realized, yeah, that's right. I got to be sort of the duped guy in this story. That's the only way the movie will work. Fortunately, Peter, you know, had the insight to see that. And you know, I can relate to being that dopey guy. And, yeah, why not? You get to spend the night with Linda Fiorentino. Who wouldn't?
Well, it's like he's playing Jimmy Stewart and Linda Fiorentino is kind of Barbara Stanwyck almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
She even calls herself Mrs. Neff at one point, doesn't she?
I believe so, yeah. Yep.
So kind of a nod back to your dad's sexy profession as an insurance salesman?
Yeah, and I think that was a Steve Brancic thing. I don't think, you know, I think that was in the original script. What Linda really responded to is that she got to be the guy in the movie. You know, she got to be, you know, she'd already sort of played the cute girl or what, you know, she'd been the, so for her it was really, really, it was a delight to all of a sudden get to be sort of like a badass in the movie. I remember shooting that scene with where she's talking to J.P. Walsh on the phone in Peter's kitchen, you know, the morning after. And I remember she's smoking a cigarette. And I think I said, you know what, Linda, you should just put out the cigarette in the pie. You know, and because I really, you know, you couldn't go far enough with her being obnoxious. You know, it just, you know, because it always worked no matter, you know, and it's like it probably could have even taken it a little more. But yeah, she was delightful.
Well, and I love that she gets away with it, too.
Yeah, I think my first reaction was like when she gets away, when I'm reading the script, I was just thinking to myself, God, I just like wish that limo would just get broadsided by a garbage truck. I was like, can't get away. And then sort of like, yeah, it's sort of perfect that she gets away. Good guys don't always win. We shot one scene twice where Peter Berg's in jail at the end and he's talking to his lawyer. In Steve's original script, he wanted J.T. Walsh to be the lawyer. Right. But Peter Berg was so dumb, he even got, you know, Linda Fiorentino's lawyer. We actually, on the day, we shot the scene, you know, and I was like, I'm not really sure if that's going to work. I'd love it if it did, but let's do sort of an insurance policy here. So we had JT come in and do the scene, and then we also had another actor, and we just shot the scene twice that day. And then when we put the movie together, it just was too much in a way, like, what is JT Walsh? I mean, it was just like, it became too much of a, like, how did that happen? It was like just one too many things. So we ended up going with the other actor, you know, who did a great job. And that just sort of like bewildered look on, I can still see it now, like, Peter Berg, I think he's chewing gum, and he just drops the phone and looks at him like, oh, man, I am so fucked. And then, oh, and I love another actor, I think his name's Jack, the way he, but you left your fingerprints on the thing, you know, he was so fantastic. Anyway, it was fun.
Well, and I love his, the Peter Berg's whole backstory, too, with that first marriage and everything. That was such a nice twist as well, you know, something you're completely not expecting.
Yeah, that was actually the one shoot that we did after we finished the film. We realized, you know what, we should visualize that for the audience, you know, his the marriage to Trish. So we brought in that actor and did those couple of little flashback things
that are in the movie, which kind of helped fill it out a little bit.
Is that actor an actor or an actress?
He was now a she.
Because I was wondering, with just the one name in the credit, I was like, you know, Serena. I was like, okay, is that one of those like Cher or?
I think he was post-operative or something like that. I can't remember. I think maybe he didn't want his parents to know or something like that. I don't know. He wanted some anonymity. Yeah, that was we shoot that 1991. I think it was released in 94. Yeah, we shot in 93. Yeah. So you know, the world's changed a little bit since then.
All right, we're back and we're talking about The Last Seduction. Now, Krista, I've called this film a neo-noir. What are some of your other favorite neo-noirs?
I don't know. You could probably argue that it isn't really noir because it has a happy ending, but big fan of Bound.
Oh, yeah. I was a big fan of Romeo is Bleeding when it came out.
Well, you know, I mean, we've all got, you know, our little secret buttons. But yeah, I loved Bound. Also, Miami Blues is another great one.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny because I mean, we're sort of in the 90s here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about 90s neo-noir, To Die For, funny, dark. Memento is another one. The thing with Memento is that its trickiness can be kind of off-putting, but I don't know. I liked it. I really, in spite of the fact that it was a little bit big for its britches and what it was trying to attempt, I actually liked it a lot.
Have you ever seen White Sands? That's a really good one, too, with Willem Dafoe and Mickey Rourke. It's one of those where you see it and you go, gosh, Mickey Rourke really was good at one point.
Yeah, he was. Although, you know, I liked The Wrestler.
Yeah, nothing wrong with The Wrestler.
Whatever else you might have to say about it, it really does read as classic noir in a lot of ways. Also, I'm a big fan of a lot of foreign noir, like The Square, Australian film The Square. It's your standard, you know, bag of money film. Guy's having an affair, ends up with a bag of money, wackiness ensues. You know, also, it has one of the best happy endings that isn't a happy ending, where, you know, he lives, but he's completely destroyed by everything that he's been through. It's just the darkest happy ending of all time. Really, really good. Another big foreign favorite of mine is El Aura, you know, which is Ricardo Darín. It's a film where a guy, an epileptic man, wants to plan the perfect heist and falls into the midst of some criminal behavior. And again, wackiness ensues. It's the same actor who was in The Secret in Their Eyes. Yeah, I don't know if you're aware of that one, but I love him, Ricardo Darín. He, in my mind, is almost like the modern Richard Widmark because he has that like kind of wormy, disreputable kind of factor, but yet you're so sympathetic to him and you go with him. You know, you're willing to go along with whatever whacked out scheme, you know, he's come up with. And there's just something really appealing about his face.
Your mention of Widmark, of course, reminds me of another Nicolas Cage movie when they tried to remake Kiss of Death, that horrible abomination, yeah, with David Caruso and Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, not so much.
Yeah, I guess I would imagine that for every good neo-noir that there was during this time period, there were probably, what, 3-4 bad ones, maybe more?
Of course. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, but I tend to sort of mentally separate period films and modern films, even though period films that were made in the 90s or now but are aping the original time period versus, you know, like Chinatown, you know, or L.A. Confidential, and then neo-noir, where you're in now. It's contemporary, whether contemporary was the 90s or the 80s or whatever, you know, Bonnie Heat or Drive, you know, it's the same type of thing in that it has a modern setting. And, you know, I think that when you fall into that fetishization, I mean, not that Chinatown is wonderful, it's a wonderful, wonderful film, but it's a different experience when you're watching a period film. Because it sort of makes, there's a distance, you know, whereas a film that you're watching in the time period that it was made, it has more immediacy, you know. I mean, I also think that, you know, unfortunately, this time period that we live in now, you know, there's a lot of that sort of self-referential wink, wink, Yeah, I mean, I love Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, oh, my heart. Love that film. However, it does really fall into the referential winking at what went before.
Right, but it does that in a very smart way, which is nice.
Oh, I think so, too. I think so, too. And then, of course, you know, I mean, I love pulp covers, pulp paperback covers, so that.
Yeah, with that whole Mike Shane kind of character. Yeah, so good.
Yeah, I really, really like that. And you know, and I also like the mix of humor with noir that can be kind of an uneasy, awkward thing sometimes, depending on, you know, who's doing it. But, you know, something like In Bruges, you know, very funny, you know, but also very dark. You know, you can, I mean, even To Die For, you know, has a tongue-in-cheek aspect, but it's also pretty dark as well.
You bring up an interesting point as far as the whole films that are set in a period versus films that are set now. There's also those kind of offbeat hybrids where you've got something like The Grifters, where they're taking a source novel from so far ago and updating it for modern time. I know a lot of people love The Grifters. When I saw it, I was too young, so I was just like, yeah, I like a funny John Cusack, and I wasn't getting the funny John Cusack at that point, so I need to go back and watch it again now.
Yeah, you should. You should. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's a tough question. Can you take a vintage novel and set it modern? Good question. I'm trying to think of an example.
I mean, we covered The Bird with the Crystal Plumage a few months ago, which was an updating of Screaming Mimi, but still that time period was only like, what, 20-some years. So I wonder if there's a shelf life for that.
At their core, the plots are, you know, they're universal. You know, I mean, I don't think that any of the classic novels, you know, that transcend their time period, the reason why they transcend their time period is because they are timeless. One of the traps that I think that a lot of pulp writers fall into is, well, I mean, partially because you're working so fast that you don't really have time to think twice about it. But a lot of times you're working so hard to try to be hip and now and a go-go, you know, in whatever your time period may be, that 10 years pass and it's just laughable, because things become dated when you can feel the writer trying to be hip. You know, if the writer is just telling you the way the world is with no investment in how cool it is, then that transcends time periods. Whereas, you know, when you get somebody who's way too invested in whatever's trendy right at this moment, that'll date faster than, you know, yesterday's Caesar salad.
So where do you fall with somebody like a Chandler with his kind of, his metaphors are pretty out there. To me, they all work, and to me, they don't necessarily date, but what do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously a lot of the things that he refers to are dated, but, you know, he is of his time period in a way that, you know, you are reading about that time period, and it's giving you a window into a different way of thinking. You know, he's not invested in being hip, if that makes any sense. You know, I mean, I'm thinking more in terms of like our man Flint.
Right.
Right. He's hip. He's happening. He's now. You know, and it's camp now. You watch it and it's amusing. But it's so invested in the coolness of that time period that it doesn't have that universal appeal. And I think a lot of the stuff that's happening now is gonna go that same route, you know, 50 years from now. But with Chandler, I mean, there are flaws. I mean, I don't think he's a perfect writer by any means, but I don't fault him for, you know, the vernacular of his time, because, you know, I think he was just telling it like it was.
So when it comes to your own writing, who are some of your heroes that you look up to that you hope someday that people put a Christa Faust next to a blank?
Oh, Richard Prather. Richard Prather is my hero. He is a really prolific pulp author who wrote a character called Shel Scott. And I can't defend him as being any kind of genius, you know, or writer for the ages, but they are funny. They are all set in Los Angeles, so they're full of 1940s and 50s Los Angeles, which I love. And they don't take themselves too seriously. They're funny. I can just read them like potato chips.
Now, I know a lot of people kind of get caught up. I mean, we've talked about neo-noir and about some of the, you know, the shadings of this kind of stuff. And we could even, you know, start slicing stuff up and saying, you know, period films of this and blah, 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 blah. When it comes to your writing, when it comes to like the Angel Dare novels, Chokehold and Money Shot, do you consider those as being in any particular category?
Well, I think that they fall more in the category of hard-boiled rather than noir. And I mean, this could be a whole separate debate, and people love to dig into this and, you know, this is noir and this isn't. And, you know, I mean, really.
I was at NoirCon, I know.
But that being said, I think that a pretty handy distinction is that in noir, it's the downward spiral. Everyone is fucked. In hard-boiled, you have a morally questionable hero who walks among people who are fucked, but is not himself fucked or herself fucked. Because by the end of the story, you are going to continue on to more adventures. And it's kind of difficult, I would even say impossible, to have a series of noir. Because if you do noir right, at the end of that story, everyone is fucked. There is no chapter two. There is no electric boogaloo. You're done. You're either in the ground or you're never going to recover.
Is there more in store for the Angel Dare series?
Well, I would love to. I mean, I have a third novel in mind. It's just that I do tie-ins and novelizations. That's my day job. You know, and that day job is voracious. It takes up a lot of my time. So it's just a matter of, you know, finding the spare minutes to work on a little fun project again.
Yeah, what's that like? What's it like doing novelizations and tie-ins? Especially, let's talk about novelizations first, where you're kind of working on, are you working from a screenplay at that point?
Yes. With novelizations, they give you a screenplay, and a lot of times it is not the final draft, because the novelization and the film have to come out at the same time. So you're often working on your novel at the same time as they're working on the film, and changes may happen, which makes novelizations kind of a fun artifact for fans, because it gives them a peek into an older version of the screenplay. The script that I had for Snakes on a Plane, it was called Pacific Air Flight 226 or whatever the flight number was, and the Sam Jackson character was white.
Yeah, your novelization for Snakes on a Plane, I mean, when that arrived in the mail, I was like, what the hell is going on here? Because it was so thick, and I was like, the movie is only 2 hours long. What can be in Snakes on a Plane, the book?
Let me tell you something, honey. Doing novelizations is like working in the cheese doodle factory, okay? They give you a teaspoon full of salt and artificial cheese flavor and orange food coloring, and you have to puff enough air into it to make it seem like food.
What's it like doing the whole tie-in thing? I know that you're working on some Fringe books. You've worked on Supernatural. I loved your Supernatural adaptation.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Yeah. Tie-ins are different because it's further adventures. So you're freer. You know, you're not married to a plot. You can basically have the characters do whatever you want them to do within the obvious constraints of the nature of the character and the nature of the franchise. I mean, it's funny. I get a lot of, especially with Fringe, but even with some of the other properties as well, people telling me, oh, well, you know, you better not make those Fringe novels dirty. I know that you write porn, so, you know, you better not make those Fringe novels dirty. And it's like, well, I don't think that people understand. This is not my personal fan fiction. This is a job. And if I wanted to make the Fringe novels dirty, Bad Robot would stop me. They wouldn't publish it. I am beholden to Bad Robot, to Titan, and to Warner Brothers. You know, those people choose the type of book that I write, not me. You know, and every single plot point, every single new character, everything I do has to be pre-approved before I can even write one word.
Yeah, I was really kind of hoping that your character from the Supernatural book would make it back into the series at some point.
Oh, the female character?
Yeah, I loved her. She was great.
Boy, it's funny because that character has been very, I don't know, people have opposite reactions to her. Some people love her and some people feel that she's a, quote, Mary Sue. You know, which I guess now stands for any female in science fiction or fantasy who is not a pussy. But what's funny about that is that, again, it's that not understanding the difference between a professional job and fan fiction. For the sake of that project, that Supernatural novel, my persona in that story, the I guy that I represent in that story, was Dean. I'm Dean, you know, because it's his POV throughout the whole story. So I kind of had to put myself in his head, you know, and then create, because I was asked to by my publisher, a romantic interest for him who I would find hot. So the creation of that character came totally from the opposite side of the spectrum. that's not who I want to be. That's who I want to fuck.
You know, I'm not familiar with the Mary Sue term. It sounds vaguely familiar.
Okay. It's actually really interesting, and I'm fascinated by, there's a lot of talk going on in the world of sci-fi, fantasy, fandom, etc. And I guess what it stems from is a piece of fan fiction in which a woman wrote a story where she has adventures with, I think, the character from Star Trek. So there's a character who is so obviously a stand-in for the author. You know, so it's like, I get to make out with Dean Winchester and I get to have adventures with Kirk and Spock or whatever. That as a fanfic writer, you want to create a perfect, flawless, magical, gorgeous character. And then that's your fantasy version of yourself who then interacts with your characters that you are crushing on. That's the Mary Sue concept. But what's funny is that idea has sort of been extrapolated to refer to any female character who is tough or strong or attractive. Let's get real, kids. What is Mike Hammer? Mike Hammer is Mikey Sue. You know, he is Mickey Spillane. Okay. Why is it that if women want to write a character that is aspirational, that they can imagine and fantasize that they are, like Bridget Gregory in The Last Seduction, I aspire to be that, but I don't see her as a Mary Sue. Yet, people have a tendency to dismiss wish fulfillment fantasies of women as somehow being less valid than the wish fulfillment fantasies of guys like Spillane and Chandler.
You were talking about the eye guy for Supernatural. When it came to the eye guy for Fringe, who was that?
Well, I'm doing three. It's a trilogy. And each book is centered around one of the main leads. So book one is Walter, book two is Olivia, and book three is Peter. So I am Walter in book one, I am Olivia in book two, and I am Peter in book three. You know, I mean, that's my job, is to put myself in the skin of someone else's character that might not necessarily be a person that I, given my druthers as a writer, would create.
Who was the most fun to be in?
I don't know. That's a good question. Between the three French characters?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Walter is so daffy. You know, that was pretty entertaining. And, you know, I was raised by sort of hippie intellectuals, you know, around that time period. So I kind of relate to him, you know, in a way that it's tougher to relate to an ass-kicking FBI agent, you know, than a sort of bumbling professor who's a lot like my mom.
When are those coming out?
I think the first one is due in April. I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's like something along the lines of like April, August, and October, possibly.
Now, you've done a lot of kind of one-off Kindle books lately, too.
I have a series, which is kind of like my tribute to Richard Prather. That's the Butch Fatale, Dyke Dick, my attempt at a funny Private Eye series that's also very sexy.
How many of those are there?
Well, there's two, one out and one in the works.
Let's go ahead. We're going to take another break and play a preview from next week's show.
Scorsese brings us a startling vision. An extraordinary story. The Last Temptation of Christ.
That's right, from The Last Seduction to The Last Temptation of Christ, that is. We'll be back in a special episode just in time for Easter, and Rob St. Mary will be back in his new digs in Aspen by then. Until then, I want to thank our special guest, Krista Faust, for coming on the show. Krista, where's the best place for folks to go if they want to, you know, get the scoop on when you have new stuff coming out or where they can see sexy pictures of your feet?
KristaFaust.com is the hub, obviously. You can follow me on Twitter, Faust Fatale, on Twitter. I have a Facebook page as well, all that stuff the young kids are into, you know, that My Face and Twit Space and all that stuff. So
My Twit Face?
That hot, trendy new stuff, you know, that the kids dig.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me. It was really a pleasure. It's been too long since I have. So thanks to everybody else for listening. If you got something to say, be sure to stop by our website, projection-booth.com. And we'll have links over to Chris's stuff there. And please leave us some feedback. And it would be great if people would go over to the 2013 Rondo Award sites and vote for us for the best horror podcast. Are we a horror podcast? Not really. Are we the best? Maybe. Are we a podcast? Yes, we are definitely a podcast, and for that reason alone, you should vote for us.
thank you can also be very effective.
Could you leave? Please.
Well, I haven't finished charming you yet.
You haven't started.
Give me a chance.
Go find yourself a nice little cowgirl, make nice little cow babies, and leave me alone.
I'm hung like a horse. Think about it.